Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuva, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic Congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
I've named this Reclaiming Society, and part of my incentive for doing this was kind of the hope that I could fit in with Pastor Mark's beginning message last week on the opioid crisis, because he said he was going to, continue that for a few weeks when he comes back. And the opioid crisis is one of several cultural crises we have now. It's not the only one. You know, we have immigration, we have racial issues, we have abortion, life, definition of the family, there are other things. Now, as it turns out, the opioid crisis is kind of near and dear to me because that's my area of work. And the two other crises that we face medically are the childhood obesity epidemic and the access to care. And so those three things, but the opioid crisis tends to take the headlines on this. Now, so the question, I think, in as we consider the idea or the truth of reclaiming the culture is, should we actually think in these terms? Should we think in terms of what we can do as a believing community in areas like the opioid crisis and other cultural crises? And if so, if we should consider that, what's the basis? On what basis do we go forward? And then beyond that, what should our strategy be? What's a winning strategy for us as a believing community and those like us as we face the cultural crises that are going on around us in our culture? One of the stories that may give us some insight here was the story when David was, he was on raids, and he had just come back to Ziklag and with his men, and their wives, their children, and their possessions had been, their camp had been raided, and everything had been taken. The men were really unhappy. In fact, they were talking about stoning David. So David did what we would hope most of us would do in a crisis situation. He went to the father, and the 1 Samuel 38, which is slide 27. Let me apologize right now to the sound booth, because I may skip around in the effort of staying within my time allotment here. But slide 27, 1 Samuel 38. David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?" Okay, I'm going to stop right there a second. You can leave that slide up. You know, it seemed like an obvious question, or an easy question, but it was important for David to have this answer, as it is for us as we look at this. You know, in 1 Corinthians, it says, Paul said, "We are God's fellow workers. We are God's building." So Paul knew that when he labored in the lives of these Corinthian believers, that he was working with God in God's work. And that was important for Paul to know. Yeshua said this. He said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son does in like manner." So we have the example of Yeshua, who didn't just charge into a situation assuming that he was supposed to be there. He listened for the Father, and what we see in the life of Yeshua is what a life looks like that's listening perfectly to the Father and obeying perfectly and doing the work the Father is doing, and that's, of course, that's our goal. And we know in Psalm 127 that it says, "If the Lord does not build the house, they labor in vain that build it." So it's our incentive to ask this same question. And I think the answer for us may very well be the same answer that David got. And you'll see that in the slide. "Pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue them." So I think it's very likely a word to us as a community that we are to pursue reclaiming this broken culture, this broken society that we're members of. Because we can be assured, as David was, that we will overcome and we will rescue all. Now, going back to kind of the basis of this, I'm going to skip a few slides here, but Dennis touched on this, and I think Pastor Mark does also. You know, Adam and Eve were originally given the mandate to rule the earth, And they capitulated, and the mandate was given to Satan, who became the prince of the power of the air. And our rule was given to Satan by our ancestor, and then we released that. Now, it's important to know that this decision not only impacted Adam and Eve individually, but it impacted the entire creation. Romans 8, slide 35, please. Romans 8, 19 through 22 says, "The anxious longings of creation wait eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now." And so we see a picture here of the whole of creation groaning because of the decision made. Creation didn't get a chance to decide this. Adam and Eve decided this, but it impacted all of creation. Now, you know, part of our understanding here in the work of Christ is that when he said it is finished, one of the things he was saying here is that everything needed to purchase back all of creation was done. Now, that didn't mean that that was all accomplished at that time. In part of our vision, part of our understanding is there's a difference between the purchase and the redemption of man, the purchase and the redemption of all creation, and the possession of all creation. It's two separate things. We can possess creation because we were redeemed and because creation has been redeemed by the blood and the death of Yeshua. And we can see this in several passages that support the idea that for many, many years, the body of Messiah was thinking, well, you know, when Jesus comes back, he's going to get all this done. And but there are verses that would lead us otherwise. If you look at 1 Corinthians, and I think this is slide 37, it said, "For he must reign until he put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that will be abolished is death." Now, the implication here is this. If the last enemy is going to be done away with from Yeshua, then there's some enemies before the last enemies that need to be dealt with. And so I guess our question is, well, how do we deal with them? In Hebrews 10, and slide 39, it says this, "But he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies be made a footstool for his feet." And so there are victories to be attained. There's possession to be accomplished by us as he is sitting, waiting for his enemies to be made a footstool for his feet. We are part of the solution here, co-laboring with him in our culture, in our society. One of the reasons it's important for us to take a look at this can be seen in Habakkuk 2:2. And it says, "Write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it." So Habakkuk was saying, you know, with any vision, it's important to find some degree of clarity, because once we get clarity, we can run with the vision. If it's not clear where we're going, if it's not clear where we started, it's really hard to run with it. And for this reason, I think this discussion, again, which was initiated last week by Pastor Mark, I think is a very pertinent discussion to us to consider. The second reason I think it's important for us to discuss is because for us to get victory and to achieve what's been purchased, there has to be victory in the spirit realm first. And this is one of the areas where intercessors come in. And I've seen this happen with a lot of our faithful intercessors over the years I've been here, where they're interceding and possessing and claiming things that need to be claimed in the spirit realm for those of us here to move forward in the areas we need to move forward in. We see this in the life of Abraham. This idea is oftentimes thought to be kind of a current charismatic idea, but this is in the context of Abraham, our father. It says, a father of many nations have I made you. This is slide 41, Romans 4:17. In the presence of him who believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. So when we intercede and we do this work, we're not doing something that hadn't been done before. This was described in our ancestor Abraham. And I think another reason for discussing this is, it has to do with where are we going, okay? If we can actually reclaim society, what's it going to look like for it to be reclaimed? I mean, we can see the problems, but it may be helpful for us to get a picture for what could happen, what could be, what are the potential purposes behind different aspects of our society. Just for the sake of discussion, could we have slide 43 on society? Is the community of people living in a particular country or region having shared customs, laws, and organizations. It's a group of people bound together, oftentimes by the dictates of living in the same geographical region. Now, this is different from culture, which is in slide 45. It has to do with the institutions and achievements of a particular people. We have many cultures in our society. So the goal here is not to transform the individual cultures. The goal is to see the society transformed. A vision that's been articulated here is that basically when you're looking at a culture being transformed, what we're saying is there's going to be evidence, tangible evidence of the kingdom of God within that society. And that's simply what a reformed culture is going to look like. The Reformation is the expression of the kingdom of God in a visible, tangible form in that society. You know, we can see this in the life of Daniel. This is slide 49 in Daniel 1. It says this, the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So these men now Daniel purposed not to be defiled, but these men were educated secularly at this point. At no choice of their own, but they were put in a secular institution. Daniel 1:19 through 20, slide 51, you can read with me as I read, but there was no one found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for wisdom and understanding, the king consulted them. He found them 10 times better than the magicians and conjurers who were in the realm. So through their influence, they influenced the highest level of government. We see this in Daniel 2:47. I don't have a slide here, but Nebuchadnezzar is saying, God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords and the revealer of mysteries, since you've been able to reveal this mystery. Now, it was supernatural. He had a dream. Daniel had the interpretation of the dream. But that was in the context of a secular education and knowing a lot about the culture that they were in. So Daniel and these men made a difference in the culture at the highest levels. Now, someone who played a key role in this, but I have not thought of very often, and perhaps you've missed it too, is the prophet Jeremiah. Slide 57. Jeremiah 29:4-7 says this, and again, read along with me. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent from exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, and plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and become the father of sons, daughters, and take wives for your sons. And give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters. And multiply there, and do not decrease. And seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare. So, you know, Jeremiah, when Israel went into captivity, because of the prophet Jeremiah, they knew that they were not to look at this as a temporary situation. They were supposed to settle in and make a difference. this temporary mindset, it's kind of the mindset of we're just passing through. Back in the 60s, I felt like this was very common because of the Cold War. We were the generation that was trained to get under little desk in schools because of atomic attack. I'm not sure what that would have done, but you know, we got under desk, and we were raised with the idea that this was a possibility, that nuclear war was a possibility, and the problem of the end of the earth was a possibility. So the idea of a pre-trib rapture fit in perfectly with that idea. Now, if you have that, I'm not saying that you're going to make the mistakes that were commonly made, but one of the mistakes that I felt, and many people felt at that time, was, look, if all this mess is going to be taken care of, it's the old phrase, the quicker we fly, the sooner you fry, kind of an idea, that, you know, we don't have to fool with it. This problem, we're just passing through. This is your problem. I'm out of here soon anyway, so you take care of it. And within that context, we had growing government step in and do what the body of Messiah stepped out of. I'm not a big UN fan, personally, but I look at what the UN's doing in healthcare. They're stepping in and doing things that the church has not done because there was a vacuum there. So I have to look at it and say, hey, I mean, there's some stuff they're doing that's good. Now, granted, I think we could do it better, but we're not. We're not doing it better. And so they at least are doing that. And so this temporary mindset can be a real hindrance to making a difference in the culture that we are living in. There's a book called The Voice of Reformation by Robert Henderson, where he describes the seven mountains of society. And he describes, this is slide 61, I believe is next, 59 and 61. He describes these mountains as the molders of society that fashion the mindset, the viewpoint, and the lifestyles within our multicultured society. And if we free the cultures that constitute our society, these seven mountains must be reformed and reclaimed for the kingdom of God. There are exceptions to this, but there's been, to a large degree, the molders of the viewpoint, lifestyles, and mindset of our culture has not been people of faith. It's been the secular world. And so we go out as people of faith, and we're fighting that. And we have to fight that. But part of the strategy for fighting it is not just short-term, it's long-term, and getting people into those realms who are going to begin to make a difference here. This author identifies seven mountains: the mountain of religion, family, and I think this will come up on a slide too, education, government, business, arts, and entertainment and media. Let's look at a couple of those. I feel like in my own personal journey, medicine could fit. Obviously, if you've gone to see a doctor and you've paid the bill, you know it fits in the business. But there are aspects of it, too, that fit into the church. I took some courses on chaplaincy at Denver Seminary last year, and I was amazed how many parallels there were between what I do as a primary care provider and what a chaplain does. And the medicine and healthcare could kind of fit in both, I think. Let's look at... there we have the seven mountains described by this one author. I'm not saying this is the only way to look at it, but it does provide kind of a schematic for thinking in these terms. Let's look at the slide 65, the religious mountain. I think the author made the point here that there won't be any reformation unless the church is the impetus and driving force behind it. It's from this mountain that destiny, divine destiny, enters the hearts of many people who would become and are to become reformers. And I think we're really blessed here. I know many, many sermons, many, many sermonettes speak to our identity. And Pastor Mark's last week was the same. He was encouraging us to embrace the identity in Messiah, to embrace the authority in Messiah on an individual basis, because this will make a difference how we charge into this culture. It's who we think we are. It's the old saying, the doctor's word is not the last word. And he was saying, okay, you don't, when you encounter a healthcare crisis, just make your first stop prayer and not the doctor's office. It doesn't mean you can't go to the doctor's office, but it's just don't make that your first stop. And so we hear that from the pulpit. We're hearing things which do impart destiny and purpose, and we're very blessed in that regard. And I want to come back to this mountain in a few minutes, time permitting. The family mountain is the second mountain, and this is where the value system of the nation comes forth. Without values, there is no foundation on which society can build. You know, with the homeschool movement, which we were a part of, and the church were almost like two porcupines trying to cuddle together to get warm. You know, we had a hard time figuring out how does family fit in church, and the church was having a hard time figuring out what do we do with these families. You know, because there was a stirring and a change going on, but neither was designed to function independent of the other. We're to move in and function together, and this is the family mountain, the second the mountain. Third is the education mountain, and this is the equipping mountain. And these three mountains, according to this one author, are the pipeline through which reformers are produced. The individuals, the people that are going to make a difference in society. The education, family, and church need to work together, which allows people to enter into their sphere. See, my sphere is the healthcare industry. That's why I could relate to the opioid crisis. If you're a patient on opioids, you can relate to that too. But there's spheres of influence you have that others don't have, where you influence people that would never come to church. I remember I was working in the emergency room of this big army hospital years ago, and there was another doctor working there, and he was an atheist. So we had just cordial conversations. He said, you know, I just recently have come to believe there is a God. And what did it was this. In our conversation, he said he drove his car up in the mountains, got caught in a blizzard, tried to start digging his car out, couldn't do it, began to get sleepy. So he said, I'm just going to sit down and take a nap, which, of course, is one of the first signs of hypothermia. So he was getting ready to sit down, go to sleep, and die. And so he sat down by his front tire. He started drifting off, and he heard this voice say, you idiot, get in the car and turn the heater on. So he thought, yeah. So he got in the car, turned the heater on, and survived. Well, I don't believe God really viewed him as an idiot, but he had to speak to him in terms he understood. But when he had that experience, he knew there was a God. And so as he and I related around this, the fact that I was there in this emergency room gave me an audience with him that I don't know to this day whether he's ever been in a church or not. And I had the same experience. I was a young flight surgeon in the Air Force, and we would cover the emergency rooms. We had to do our rotation. I was covering the emergency room one night, several nights, and there was a young Jewish medical technician there. We were both in our mid-20s, so I was a doctor and he was a tech, but he was also a nephrology technician, and I thought he was really smart. There was no question he was smarter than I was. So we began to relate and just talk. And so over time, I was at that time in a ministry that really encouraged scripture memory, so I was actually memorizing the book of Romans. So I would study, I would just share with him what I was learning from Romans. He would share with me what he was learning from the Talmud. And we kept this up for months and months. Finally, he said, you know, I think I'm going to start reading Romans. And so he started reading Romans, and we continued our dialogue. And on his own, he came to faith in Messiah through just reading the scriptures. But it wasn't my plan. It's just that God put us together outside of the church in a sphere of influence where I could make a difference. That was the realm where I could kind of go in and invade society. So the government mountain is the next. So ideally, it's supposed to empower its citizens to meet their own needs. It's not designed as the mother who's going to meet all of our needs. And so this is what's supposed to happen. The business mountain is kind of the finance mountain. This is slide 73. It's the engine that drives Reformation. And some of you as business owners and businessmen are already doing this. The arts and entertainment mountain is the prophetic mountain whose sound should shape society and impact and discipline the nations. And we see the opposite of that happening oftentimes, but it is happening. I was talking to one of my kids just before on the way here. He had just gone to a home group where some rappers were who had come to faith were presenting the home group meeting, and he said it was awesome. That how they were kind of going into this area, and they were becoming a prophetic voice in the rapper scene to those that were into rap music. Finally, the media mountain. It's the Watchman Mountain, from which watchmen arise who will make a clear trumpet sound without a hidden agenda and a spin which distorts stories and reports. So that's kind of where, in this one author's opinion, we're going with this. Now, I'm going to come back to the religious mountain and just make a couple of comments here. One is there is a distinction that the author makes between the church and religion in our culture. And I think the admonition is this, and this has been spoken by some very well-known commentators. We as believers have to learn to partner with unbelievers if we're going to see the society changed. We have to get comfortable. We don't have, there's, I've seen this in several situations. There's a tension. If you're dialoguing with an unbeliever in the culture, there's usually a tension. Now, you can have peace, but the tension is there because you're remaining faithful to the tenets of your faith, but you're also contacting someone who's not. And so oftentimes, we were taught that if that tension is not there, it means you've either compromised or you're not really connecting. And so we have to be able to live with attention if we want to see with working with various religions. Now, they don't have to know why we do what we do. We're not going to compromise our faith. We're not going to change and say maybe they're right. It's just simply a matter of us being willing to work with them while we know the truth. Now, having said that, I want to come back to the church part of the religious mountain. We've covered this several times in the last few parashas. The one the week before last spoke in Deuteronomy 4 of keeping the commandment. It was actually singular, as a testimony to the nations. So this is the church part right here. This is the church equation. So Moses tells the children of Israel, keeping the commandments is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples. So when society see the people of God living out the commandments of Torah, verse 8 says, they say this, what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as the righteous as this whole Torah? See, that points out one of the reasons it was such a big mistake for part, at least, of the Western church to jettison the Torah. It cut us off from an anchor that was supposed to make a difference in the culture that we lived in. Deuteronomy 4, 6 to 8 basically says that. I'm not going to go back and quote that. But see, the Torah is both a law, Torah, teaching, and a revelation. And so what that means is when we live out the Torah, we become a living revelation of God to the people that we're in contact with. We're their revelation. I remember when I think I've shared this before, but early in my spiritual journey, I was in a family, and I'd heard these abstract concepts, husband loves your wives, wife. I was single, so they were abstract to me. Wives, submit to your husbands, and then, you know, dads are the priests of the home and all that kind of stuff. But my parents did better than I would have done, given the information they were given. But from my perspective, I don't know that I had seen that happen, at least the way I thought it would happen. And so I was in this Christian home, and I saw this young couple with their two young children relating, and a light went off in my mind that, oh, that's what it looks like. That's what this is talking about. So as we live out the Torah, lights can go off on the minds of those around us. We're not having to convince them of anything. We're just living out the tenets of our faith, but it does give a revelation to them. So it gives the world an opportunity. Slide 79, Jeremiah 22:3 says this. Now, before I read this, so what we have here is, so we as the church of believers are called to faithfulness to Messiah, living out the Torah. It's a Messiah-centered Torah lifestyle, Spirit-empowered. I mean, we use those phrases knowing that they're true. So when Israel deviated from that, then the prophet spoke to them to bring them back to that. Jeremiah 22:3 says this, "Thus saith the Lord, do justice and righteousness, and deliver the one who has been robbed from the power of his oppressor. Also, do not mistreat or do violence to the stranger, the orphan, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place." So, in this situation, see, the idea of doing justice to a widow and an orphan used to be in the purview of ancient Near Eastern kings. And so when our king gives this instruction and then we live this out, it's a revelation of the character of God and gives evidence of his royalty. Also, in that parashah, it says, and do not shed innocent blood. And then it goes on to say that he executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So the Torah paints love here, defines love as giving food and clothing. So love is an act of kindness to somebody in need. That was the Torah definition of love. You see, Jeremiah 22:16 says this, and this is slide 81. He pled the cause of the afflicted and needy. Then it was well. Is that not what it means to know me? Declares the Lord. So the question is, well, are there within your sphere people who don't have advocates that you could advocate for? That's what this is talking about. The unborn is a real obvious example of that, but that's not the only example. There are others. And Ezekiel 16:49, this is an interesting passage. It says, "This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, but she did not help the poor and needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations." So what it's saying here is looking at a disobedience, a lack of living out kindness to the poor opened the door for arrogance. Arrogance opened the door for perversion. Perversion tends to be what we tend to like to hate. But, you know, it's really started in a different point, and that's where we're called. When Ezekiel was saying this, he was calling Israel back to this, acts of kindness. Hosea 4:1 says, "The Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land." See, the problem here was not just a lack of faithfulness. It wasn't just a lack of the knowledge of God. It was a lack of kindness. Jessica touched on this in her offertory. You know, as you extend kindness to others, then that, in the context of Torah lifestyle, speaks to them of who God is. Hosea 12:6 says this, "Therefore return to the Lord your God. Observe kindness and justice and wait for your God continually." So kindness is an evidence of repentance. Now, see, since we know some answers and we know some cause and effects, it's tempting to be the voice of condemnation or correction when someone is having a problem that's related to behavior. Like in the primary care industry, they say 85% to 90% of what we encounter can be traced to behavior. And I can only give examples from my life because that's just where it kind of touches, but you could probably do the same thing in your own spheres. So the question is, when I see a patient, my calling is to extend kindness to them, even though in my head I might be able to think, I think I know why this is happening. Now, in fact, I may not know why it's happening, but I think that. And so the question is, am I going to extend kindness to them in their need? It doesn't lead them to Christ necessarily. It may just make their journey a little less painful. But that's one of the things we can do in reclaiming the culture, is extend that kindness. I remember a couple of stories come to mind. One is Micah. Some of you know Micah. He was our number 3. And kind of the life of the party kind of a guy. And he was about 4 to 5. He was really little. And he walked out to me and said, "Hey, Dad, I have a headache." And so I looked at him and said, "Would you like for Dad to pray for you?" So he looked at me and thought for a minute, and he said, "No, thanks. I'd rather have Tylenol." And so, okay. So Tylenol tasted better. It was sweet. So I could have said, "Micah, you kid of little faith, you know." So, but what did I do? Well, you know, the kind thing to do is I gave him Tylenol. It took his headache away, and I thought maybe I can pray for him another day. Had another experience in the emergency room in Western Oklahoma. Gary and I have been there many times for various reasons, but I was in the ER about 2 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and a guy came in drunk. He had been in a bar fight, and I walked in the exam room. His nose was not even recognizable. It was like 3 pieces. His ear was hanging on by 1 piece of tissue. So my next step was to turn to the nurse, Debbie, you'll understand this, and say, "Who is plastics on call? And would you get plastic surgery on the phone?" And so the nurse went and got plastic. So I presented this case to the plastic surgeon, and I said, "This guy needs a plastic surgery repair. Can I transfer him to you?" And he said, "We don't accept transfers. You fix it." And I'm thinking, what? I'm a primary care provider, you know. But anyway, so I said, at that point, the patient didn't have any choices. I didn't have any choices. So I went into the exam room and started about a 2 or 3 hour procedure to get this guy's nose put back together, get his ear stitched back on. So now during that time, he's saying this. He's saying, "Doc, I'm really a nice guy." He's still drunk. "I don't know why these kind of things happen to me." And so I'm thinking, you're a nice guy in a bar, 2 o'clock on Sunday morning, drunk with other nice guys. You know, I'm thinking this is obvious. But you know what? The kind thing to do was to keep my mouth shut, fix his face, and let him move on. He probably wouldn't remember what I tell him anyway. But again, the choice was, okay, am I going to lay my analysis on him or just be kind? This guy's hurting. I can help him. And we probably all have situations like that where we encounter that. This is what became known in Judaism as tikkun olam. It's the idea that we can repair and fix our world. So as we think about our lives, think about the worlds, the spheres we're in. As we think about our kids, as we're raising them, one of the questions is, okay, what can we do here to fix our world? What's the influence I can bring to bear? What can I do with these kids God's entrusted me with to make sure they're lining up with God's purpose so they can go fix the world too? And this relates to the healthcare crisis. You know, it's been said this: it's better to have a fence at the top of a cliff than a good ambulance service at the bottom of the cliff. So if I, as a primary care provider, walk up, let's say, and there are different types of prevention. One is primary prevention, where you try to prevent a disease. The class that Pastor Mark is doing right now, probably for those of you that are young and or maybe some of you that are even older, you change your life, you can prevent disease. That's primary prevention. Secondary prevention is what you do when the disease is already there and you're trying to prevent complications of the disease. It's a different approach. Now, God can intervene on any one of those. This doesn't limit God. The tertiary prevention is you've got someone with a disease who has complications, and now you're trying to manage the complications to minimize the impact on this person's life. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all deal. It varies. So if I walk up to the top of this allegorical cliff and someone's there, I'm going to say one thing to that person that's at the top of the cliff. But if I walk to the bottom of the cliff and I'm talking to someone that just fell off, I'm going to say something totally different. My approach will be different. Their needs are different. And we can see this happening right now. The healing center that Debbie is directing, and Dennis and Debbie have worked to get this underway. I don't think we have a start date yet, do we? To be announced. But see, this is one of the ways we can impact our little part of the healthcare crisis. There's going to be a healing center with the opportunity of ministering at various levels to bring healing. And you see this with HIV transmission too. I used to think, and this is it's common for the church to think, well, the way to prevent HIV is abstinence. And that's true. And so that's been the church's trumpet. Stop having sex before marriage. Only have sex with one partner. And that's true. But consider this. Oftentimes in situations, there are cultures where the men can be promiscuous, but the woman cannot be promiscuous. And so the man gets it and then gives it to the woman who was not promiscuous. She was monogamous. She had sex with just her husband, but the culture fixed it so that he could do it and she couldn't. So she gets HIV. And then she has HIV and she conceives. And then the baby, most of the time, gets HIV and will be dead in 2 years. So, see, the message in that is, sure, we do an abstinence message, but that's not the only message, because some of these men aren't going to be abstinent, so if we can get them to use barrier methods where they don't get sick, they're not going to give it to their wives. And if the wives have it, there's medications we can give which will prevent the baby from getting it. And so we actually save a life and let the child live to maybe 4 or 5, or to the point where they can make their own decisions in terms of their faith or lack of it. And so these are examples of just extending kindness to others. Yeshua taught his disciples this. He said, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Isaiah said, "Nations will come to your light," speaking of Israel. And the apostles said this. See, this basically is what we're talking about, is a Torah version of evangelism. It's not so much evangelistic crusades. Paul said this, "Conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity." Peter went on to say, "Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe and glorify God in the day of visitation." I had this happen with my boss, and he was a lieutenant colonel in the emergency room. I was a contract physician. And he came up to me and said, "Would you give my daughter a prescription for birth control? I don't want to do it." And so I'm thinking, I don't think I can do this for various reasons. I said, "No, I'm sorry, I really can't do it." And I explained why. And I thought, here we had a good relationship at this point. And I said, "Well, here that goes." And but I said no. He laughed. He was kind of, he thought my position was kind of funny. But it opened up the door for discussions that went on until this hospital was closed. There was an opportunity that came that I didn't realize. It was kind of an evangelistic opportunity, but it was an action. Now, the other thing that we need to be aware of in the church is a different concept. Worship, and I'm going to just really condense this because we're short on time, but worship is not, when Yeshua said this, he said, "An hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people, the Father seeks to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship it must worship in spirit and in truth." It's not just talking about spirited worship there. It's talking about a lifestyle of submission. Worship, according to the Torah, is a mitzvah. It's obedience to the Torah. So our life, as you go into your sphere of influence, as I go into my sphere of influence, our obedience to the Torah in those spheres is a form of worship. We enjoy worship here, but we also are worshiping in our jobs. And so, just by way of reminder, the church, we as a church have a little different view of evangelism than the traditional Western church. We as a church have a little different view of worship, and both of those views will impact our ability to move into the spheres of influence and repair our society. It's not going to be an overnight process. There are stands we take. If you look at the land of Israel, there were times God intervened and did a miracle, and there were times there were long campaigns that took both to possess the land that God had given. And there are some of y'all that are on long campaigns, and there are others that may have experienced just immediate interventions. But the point is, as a church, we can be the impetus for driving a cultural change which can repair the society. I'm not sure if we'll get a chance to discuss the various mountains or not. It would be interesting discussions. I know Pastor Mark has a, I think, a plan to address this in the next few weeks. But it'll be from the church mountain, and there's a very good chance. I don't know what he's going to share, but he'll probably be dealing and imparting destiny, encouraging, embracing the authority in Yeshua, looking to God as our healer, things that we must do to impact the culture. And we can impact our culture. The word to David is a word to us. We let our light shine before men, that they may see our good works and glorify our Father who is in heaven.
Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." And we add, "In the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panav alecha ve'yihunecha. Yisa Adonai panav alecha ve'asem lecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehila Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat Shalom and Shavua Tov.